Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
Always fun to be on.
Hilliard, the Canadian House Price Index has just been released. What is it telling us?
So this index is called the Terranet National Bank Index, and it's one of two. The other one is the Canadian Real Estate Association Index. And the Terranet, in my mind, is a little bit more reliable because it takes, the idea is it takes actual prices registered at the land titles office. But what that means is it can take up to 3 months or longer to register the actual sale and the price at the land titles office. And then the other thing that the Terranet does, it takes a 3-month moving average. So you don't get huge moves in it as much as you would in the other index. So given that background, we've had now 3 months of decline in the composite index, which is pretty substantial, and year over year declines as well. So I went back and checked to see how it's done over the last couple of years, and I guess it's been dropping for 2 years now. The peak, well, May 2022, so the almost 2 years. And the drops are well, they're not, you couldn't call it a bursting of a bubble, but it's certainly the start, perhaps. So the composite is down 7.6% from the peak. Toronto is the winner, down 13.3% from the peak. And Vancouver is down 5.52% from the peak. In the most recent numbers, Calgary is the only big city that's actually up, and Calgary's up. Month-over-month up 2.3% and year-over-year up 8.8%. So those stories about all those people moving to Alberta are correct, I guess, if they're buying houses when they arrive, and they probably are. But Edmonton's down 1.6% year-over-year, so I guess they're moving to Calgary, they're not moving to Edmonton.
Well, there was a recent headline that Calgary has become more expensive than Vancouver.
No, that's not possible. I don't think so. Maybe in some categories, but I doubt it. But if you go back to June 2005, like, they have an index rating. So they took their base year as June 2005 at 100, and today the composite's at 300. So it's up, it's tripled almost next year it'll be 20 years. So that's actually not 7% annual. 7% annual it would have quadrupled. So it's a little bit less. It's probably, I'm guessing, maybe 5.5-6% annual increase, which is pretty substantial. And of course, the interesting thing though is for it to be dropping for almost 2 years straight, because that doesn't happen very often. It shows up on the graph. It actually, we put out, if people want to check, we put out on X, formerly known as Twitter. We make up a graph and put it out in. And my associate, Fraser Bitkowski, he includes the inflation rate, the wages, after-tax wages for Canadians, and several other, the mortgage, total mortgage debt in Canada. So the Vancouver, Toronto house prices have gone up almost 7% per year, and the mortgage debt has tracked it all the way up with a rate lockstep with it. But inflation rate is much lower than that. The wages are much lower than that. So people, I'm sure they're running into trouble. And of course, the thing that fooled me was they kept the interest rates so low that people could stretch and stretch and stretch and still stay with it. But now the interest rates have reset up to 5, 5.5, 6%. Now people are hitting the wall in terms of being able to afford those house prices.
Now, does that mean foreclosures are about to surge, or will they renegotiate the length of the mortgage?
So, interestingly, now this is U.S. data, but I think the same thing's happening in Canada. One of the bankruptcy professionals in the U.S., now he's talking about foreclosures, and he said, but it's also business bankruptcies as well. And he said, for the last few years, the banks have been very willing to give the borrower what's called a forbearance agreement. So the bank agrees to let you not make your full payments or skip a few payments or whatever, and you have to meet certain conditions that are in this letter. So he said, since January 1st, there's been a real change, and he said the banks are no longer patient they're not giving out the forbearance, and so that's when you start to get foreclosures. The bank basically seizes the property and sells it because they figure, we can't really make any more money on this. If prices are declining, we might as well just cut our losses. And when the bank forecloses, they always lose money because if there was any capital left in that property, the owner would have sold it and paid the bank off, right? So it's always in a losing position by the time you get to foreclosure. And what's interesting about the numbers we started out with, a lot of the foreclosure sales are not included. Some of them are. If they're listed on the MLS, then they're included, but sometimes they're not included if they're done through the bank, from the bank directly to a buyer. So obviously it's possible that things are a little bit worse than they look like in the headline numbers, because some of these foreclosure sales are not 13% lower, they're like 25, 30% lower.
If our foreclosure sales, does that mean we could see house prices drop further because they just want to get rid of that property?
Yeah, and that's what happens. The homeowner has what's called an anchor price in his mind or her mind, and they don't reluctant to drop the price below it. And they actually, they just basically will hang on, even if they can't make the mortgage payments, they'll hang on. But when the bank gets involved, or the lender, so there's a lot of shadow bank lenders now that are not banks, they are much more ruthless. They don't have an emotional attachment to a particular property or a particular price. So they just go ahead and they direct the seller to just sell it for whatever you can get for it, just get it done. So that's when prices take bigger drops. And we're sort of been in the last 2 years, have been in this phase where people, well, first of all, they were hoping to hang on to their property. They were hoping interest rates would drop. But now, after a couple of years since COVID, I guess, or actually it's getting up to 4 years now since COVID, interest rates have gone back up. The lenders are stepping in, and they just basically tell the homeowner that it's they're not going to wait any longer. They've lost patience, and it's time to sell, and they force the sale. The shadow banks, they're even more ruthless because they don't have the ability, like a bank does, to sort of carry it for a while. They have to sell. So that's the stage we're starting, and that's where you get the bigger drops in the price. The 13 to 7 to 8, 10% drops are not significant compared to what happens when you get into foreclosure times, when you get into 20, 30, 40% drops at that point.
So with home prices dropping in most of the country, how long after the prices start going down do we see a big collapse in real estate?
Well, that capitulation thing that you're talking about, or the waterfall, it's been so long since that happened, and housing is such a sensitive product politically that sometimes it doesn't actually happen in housing. It's more like a slow drip kind of thing. And you get that in the stock market, you get in other things where people just give up and throw in the towel. But the only real comparable we have is 2006 to 2012 in the U.S. 2006 is when house prices peaked in the U.S., and they went down 38% by the bottom, which was reached in 2012. So 37-38% decline. And, of course, in some areas it was much bigger than that, but that was the average, and took 6 years. So it looks like we're 2 years into this. It looks like the peak was in 2022. So 6 years would take us out to 2028, I guess.
Now, we have a lot of governments across Canada, including the federal government, putting special taxes on foreign buyers. But have foreign buyers really been much of a factor in Canadian real estate since, say, 2017?
You know, there was a story, there was a report in Vancouver, the German report came out and talked about money coming into the Vancouver housing market, and it was for real, and I think it was substantial. I think the numbers were just mind-boggling, the billions and billions of dollars. And obviously that had a big impact on Vancouver. And the same, maybe on a lesser scale, in Toronto, and even Calgary and some of the other cities, but yeah, it seems like that's maybe over now. That you know, once prices start dropping, that these there's two things. The speculators, they call it the hot money. They're looking for rising prices, and so if they see that prices have been dropping for 2 years, they're going to gradually move on to some other place. They're going to find a better place to go. On the other hand, the money launderers don't care. Like if they take a 20% loss. If they've got to launder $10 million and they buy a couple of houses and they lose 20% and they only have $8 billion, they're still very happy to have $8 billion because the money now is clean and they can move on, right? So if Canada turns, and then this is recent reports show that Canada is one of the most lax jurisdictions for chasing money launders, they're willing to accept that. So the money laundering money would still keep coming in, but the hot money, the speculative money probably has already dried up by now, I would think.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, you've been crunching some numbers. Just how does the conflict in the Middle East affect the stock markets?
Well, you know, the of course, there was the Russia-Ukraine war started a couple of years ago, and then there's the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, which started October 7th. And so I went back and looked at the stock market and at the oil price, being the two most, especially for the Middle East part. Russia's involved in the oil price as well. And it was pretty surprising to notice that the oil price had run up prior to the invasion of Gaza by Israel and the attack by Hamas on Israel. And ever since, even before October 7th, the oil price had started to come down. So it got up to $90-something, and now it's down in the low to mid-70s. So obviously that is not a concern. And even when the Houthis started attacking those ships in the Red Sea, where some of the oil tankers go, and especially container ships, it didn't seem to have much impact on the oil price. And similarly with the stock market. The stock market is within 1% or 2% of, I guess, 2% of its all-time high, 4,800, which was hit a couple of years ago. And so the Russia-Ukraine war and the Gaza-Israeli conflict and the Houthis.
And now Pakistan and Iran are exchanging missiles.
Yeah, so far it hasn't affected, you know, normally the stock price of the, I mean, now I'm used to the U.S. stock market, and that is led by these seven companies called the Magnificent Seven. They have stayed high, so they don't, the prices in the U.S. stock market have not come down. Now, interestingly enough, a couple of the other markets I looked at, the United Kingdom is trading very cheaply now. The price earnings ratio on the UK index as a whole is at 10 times compared to 22 for the S&P 500 and a much higher number for the Magnificent Seven. So the UK is getting dragged down by geopolitical events, perhaps, and also a weak economy. And Hong Kong is trading at 7 times price earnings ratio. So it's the valuation of Hong Kong, which is, Hong Kong is a much more volatile stock market than the U.S. stock market, so it's not surprising. But the gap is surprising; like it's a very large gap. China as well is trading it's been going down, but I don't think it's related to these geopolitical conflicts. It's related to the fact that the Chinese growth miracle has been fading for a number of years now, and their growth levels are much, much more modest than they had been for 20 years prior to that. So we're seeing some changes, but it doesn't seem to be related to these wars, not directly so far anyway.
Now, usually the head of RBC, Canada's largest bank, is pretty tight-lipped, but perhaps the chocolate and cheese of Switzerland has loosened up his tongue because he's talking about what's going to happen to the Canadian economy at the Davos Economic Conference.
Yeah, I was surprised. I saw that too. And they interview all these people over in Davos at this conflab they have, I think, every year. And he was quite candid about the Canadian. Now, he was talking about the Canadian consumer and the impact of interest rates on the fact that interest rates have gone up on mortgages from, say, 1.5% to 5.5%. And he was admitting at Davos that this is going to be a big problem for them, because the reason I noticed it was because in their latest results, which came out not that long ago, they were quite complacent about it. They say, well, he did say this in the interview. He said, well, so far they're handling it quite well, this increased interest rates. But I don't think that's not conclusive, because everybody tries to hang on to their house and to their car and all the stuff that they've used borrowed money to buy. Eventually somebody catches up if they can't make the payments. So, but he seemed to be taking a more serious tone at Davos than he did in the recent interviews I saw he gave in Canada. And and the other thing that's kind of notable about it is he talks about almost like he's an observer, like he's on the sidelines watching this game play. And of course, that's not correct at all. The Royal Bank is the biggest retail lender in Canada, so they've been totally involved in helping these people get involved in these excessive debt levels that may or may not be sustainable. Now, at one point, I think people were hoping that interest rates would come down quickly enough that they could hang on, but it's become apparent in the last few days, actually, that interest rates may not come down as quickly as people thought. A couple of numbers came out, and inflation numbers, there's a little uptick in inflation in Canada and the UK, and then some employment numbers as well indicate that the Federal Reserve, who leads all of the other central bank, the Federal Reserve probably won't cut rates as quickly as possible. They were talking March, now they seem to be maybe thinking June. So, and maybe not as many cuts as they thought, maybe four cuts instead of six cuts or something like that. So each cut is about 25 basis points. So four cuts indicates 1%. Well, if somebody's right on the edge in terms of their debt levels, 1% probably isn't going to make that much difference to them. And their loan may not renew anyway. But one of the things that the CEO of RBC said was that something like 40 or 50% of all the mortgages come up for renewal in the next 2 years. The variable rates plus the terms on the 5-year rates, the 4-year rates that are out there. So it's going to be a real test. And I think there's going to be more trouble than the CEO of the Royal Bank is admitting to right now anyway.
Alberta, as an Arctic cold wave swept through Western Canada, even Vancouver dropping down to minus 14 with a snowstorm. Alberta faced rolling blackouts or the possibility of it. How can that province, which is so energy rich, be on the cusp of putting people in the dark, in a deep freeze where it's minus 40?
Well, that's a good question, because I read the article in the Globe and Mail. Now, in the Edmonton and the Calgary newspapers, they were blaming it on wind turbines and solar panels. but the reality is that the wind turbines and the solar panels in Alberta don't provide a very big percentage of the energy. Energy demand hit a new high level, and basically four natural gas plants were offline. And so the Globe and Mail reported it, and it was directly from the mouth of the cabinet minister, utilities minister. He said, unfortunately, four natural gas-fired plants, they've gotten rid of all the coal plants now, and they're all natural gas-fired now, were offline, perhaps due to cold weather or maintenance or whatever, and he didn't really elaborate. And that's what caused the problem. But he was really excited, because as soon as they put out, they said, so all of us got an emergency alert on our phones, and it said, unplug your electric car and don't use your clothes dryer and don't turn the oven on, use the microwave and turn out the lights. Well, in our neighborhood, all the lights just went out within 5 minutes. All the lights went out, and they actually shed about 200 megawatts of load. It was in the evening, which is the peak time. And so the lights were on, of course, as it would be in January. And then apparently another 10 or 15 minutes later, another 200 megawatts came off. So it was enough to get us through this period. But it certainly shows that they need to manage the system better. What happened in Alberta was about 25 years ago, they bought into a plan by a company called Enron, which ended up collapsing because of some fraud problems. They had convinced everybody, almost everybody, that the best thing to do is have free markets in the electric energy business. And the problem with that is that if people have plants that are offline and there's a spike in prices and they can bring them back online quickly, they can game the system and make a lot of money. And that's what Enron got into trouble for doing. They were deliberately taking plants offline and then making a huge profit when there was a shortage of electricity. So the other thing that's the free market in the electricity energy business does not, and this the minister mentioned this, was they're not willing to pay for standby. So if they're not willing to pay for standby, then all of the operators are saying, well, I can't afford to build a plant and have it just sitting idle waiting for a moment when the government calls on me to provide electricity. So that's got to change. I think we should all decide, and maybe this will be a trigger for it, that we're willing to pay a percentage of our cost to have a couple of plants standing by that can be fired up quickly. The natural gas plant could be fired up in a very short period of time and get some extra power back into the grid.
Headlines were made when Edmonton's electric battery-powered buses failed in the cold weather. How reliable are electric vehicles when it dips down to minus 40, whether it's C or F?
Well, you know, I don't know about buses, because I think there were some other problems with other than just the cold weather, because those buses actually failed when the weather was still warmer than it is now. But cars, everybody asks me, because, you know, everybody knows I've been driving a Tesla now for coming up to 8 years. It'll be 8 years in March. What's it like in the winter? How can you know, don't you have a backup gas car or anything? I said, no, I just have the one car, and my wife has a car, but it's also electric as well. It's a Tesla as well. So the neat thing about electric cars is they come on immediately with a lot of heat. So within 2 or 3, or when it's minus 40, it takes 6 minutes, I timed it, to get the temperature of the cabin up to 21 degrees. So it's lovely. And there's an app on your phone, and you just turn it on, and there you go. You're toasty warm. And everybody else is trying to warm up the car or worrying if it'll start or something. But there were a couple of reports, especially one recently in the last 24 hours, about a bunch of cars that had been frozen out at the supercharger in Chicago. But it was Fox News that aired it, so I'm not sure if it was accurate. But I've never had that experience. Like the only time I got into trouble, if the battery goes right down to zero, why would you let the battery go down to zero? That doesn't make any sense. But if it does go right down to zero and it's cold, then you have to find a way to get some juice into it before it can accept a charge. So, the video that they showed on Fox was a whole bunch of cars, which seems very unlikely. So, but generally, the other thing that people worry about is what about idling? Like if you get caught in a snowstorm and a car goes off the road and blocks the road and you're sitting there for an hour or two, which can happen in the Rogers Pass quite often. The electric car uses very little energy. It's like a study. One of the fans of Tesla did a study, turned it on in what they call camp mode, where you can just have it keep the car warm enough for you to camp out in your sleeping bag, and it only went down about 7% from 57% down to 50% overnight, like in 8 hours. So it was no problem at all, because it's not using much energy just to keep the heat into the, because the new Teslas have heat pumps. They don't rely on the old technology. They've got these wonderful now new heat pumps. So all of that is good. The one negative, so if anybody sees this, is definitely true. When it's minus 40, the range of an electric car drops by up to half. Mine's never gone more than half, and it's usually like 40% or something. So if you have a 600 kilometer range, as my car has, it goes down, say, to 300-350 kilometers. That's not a problem. It works fine as long as you've got the range. You just maybe have to stop on a long trip. You might have to stop more frequently. After you wouldn't want it to go down to zero, so you'd stop after 200 kilometers, then stop again after 400 kilometers, and then reach your destination at 600 kilometers. So instead of just one stop, you might do two stops. So, but the stops are only 15-20 minutes, and if you program it for where you're going to a supercharger, the car knows to precondition the battery. That's the thing. So you have to precondition the battery, which basically means warming it up a little bit so it gets ready to accept a charge. Everybody's going to get used to this when electric cars are ubiquitous. And it's just because it's new now, people have a lot of questions, but it works great. Now, the electricity has to be there, though, so that's the question mark, because if all the cars were electric tomorrow, there wouldn't be enough chargers to meet the demand. So somebody's got to figure that part out.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Nice to chat with you, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMcLeodPartners.com. Find him on X at HMacBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.